And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we're coming at you live like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. If you're listening live, please join in the chat room, and you'll be able to ask our guests some questions. We have another great show for you this evening. We have an astronomy clip with Andy Fleming coming right up, and our guest for the evening is Stan Gordon. We'll be talking about the Kecksburg, Pennsylvania UFO crash and retrieval, and a lot more. You know, since I've been doing this show solo without Michael Luke helping me out with news, you know, it hasn't really been the same. So I decided to bring in my show producer, Fred Ling. Now, Fred, he's not really interested in talking, but he helps me out with the show, and he'll give me a nod now and then during the show. Right, Fred? Yeah. Thanks, Fred. Thanks. Thanks for your support. Some of you may wonder if Fred may or may not exist. But either way, he's a lot of help. That is, when he's not goofing off, he's mostly goofing off. Now, lately in the UFO news, we have Austrian officials say they are baffled to explain a UFO sighting. And dozens of people reported seeing this between 50 and 100 objects flying in formation. Now, if you look at our homepage, you'll see what I think is just a stunning image of two UFOs. So they're beautiful. They're kind of like the Cartier of UFOs, probably from Planet Prada, right, Fred? Don't look at me like that, Fred. Come on. Anyway, local media reported that the images, as taken, were pictures seen by several people. And there were between 50 and 100 of them, as I said, and they were silently flying in formation. Again, the word silently. Austrian air traffic controllers said they had been made aware of the incident and were looking into it, but declined to comment at this stage, but confirmed that there were no indication that the photo or reported sightings were fake or any type of hoax. Well, all right. Thank you, Fred. Please, just go sit over there. Thank you. Thanks. All right. Now we have Andy Fleming coming up, and he's talking about Kepler 186F. It's a very Earth-like planet. And Fred, that button. No, that one right. Fred, that button right. Yeah, right there. Yeah.
And hello, Martin and listeners. Now today we're off on the hunt for Earth 2.0. This follows hard on the heels of the recent news that a team of astronomers has announced the discovery of an Earth-sized exoplanet. What's really interesting is that the planet is within the habitable zone of Kepler-186, an M1-type dwarf star in the constellation Cygnus, about 500 light-years away from the Earth. Now, this star has at least five planets, four of which are very hot and close to their sun, while the fifth, named Kepler-186f, is in the centre of the star's habitable zone. It was discovered by the transit method, which detects planets as their orbits cross in front of their star. This causes a very tiny but periodic dimming of the star's brightness. Now, after confirmation, the astronomers used the transit information to calculate Kepler-186f's size. They found out that it's approximately 1.1 times the radius of the Earth and orbits its star once every 130 days. The astronomers estimate that the planet receives about 30% of the heat energy that the Earth does from our own sun. From an astrobiological perspective, the planet is really exciting because liquid water could exist on its surface, a precondition for life as it evolved here on the Earth. The planet is probably a rocky world too. Its gravity will also be similar to ours, and its parent star is an immensely long-lived red dwarf. This means that it will burn hydrogen virtually forever, so there will be ample opportunity for life to develop. However, although Kepler-186f shows much promise as an Earth analogue, its situation is subtly different, as its star is not the same as our Sun. Although red dwarfs are numerous, they are smaller and cooler than G2-type stars such as ours. They are also more active, sending out more solar flares and radiation. Scientists now know, however, that life is most tenacious, and once it gets going, it's extremely difficult to extinguish. Red dwarfs show much promise when searching for Earth 2.0 and the possibility of extraterrestrial life.
That's right. And, you know, it's, as you know, it's very possible. We're finding more and more of these planets out there. And, you know, I'm finding that almost everywhere I go that most people do believe that there is life on other planets out there. You know, I think people are just plain coming around. And, you know, I think Kepler has a lot to do with that, which is pretty exciting. The subject came up with a neighbor that I just met recently. And, you know, they're right there saying, oh, yeah, there's absolutely no question in my mind that there's life out there. And I asked her, what about them visiting here? She said, well, why not? We're out there exploring. I thought that was a great answer. Anyway, we're ready. It's time. Fred, go sit down over there, please. Thank you. And remember, if you want to ask our guests some questions tonight and you're listening live, jump into our chat room, which is at podcastufo.com. Just two clicks and you're in. Stan Gordon, how you doing?
We're doing fine, Morton. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Yes, thank you. And I started talking to you before the show started. And, you know, basically, almost since I started the show a couple years ago, there's been people requesting you to come on over and over again. And I'm so glad we were able to connect, and here you are.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. And, yeah, I've been involved in the field for a long time. This year is actually going to mark out 55 years that I've been involved in researching all kind of phenomena here in Pennsylvania.
Well, I got to say, you look awfully young to have that kind of years into this. But, you know, I've looked back. I saw some documentaries with you in it, you know, way back. And, yeah, I know you've been at it forever. And that's one of the main reasons, you know, people are interested in listening to what you have to say. Now you started at 10 years old. How did that happen? What made you start so young?
Well, how I got involved, it was just by sure coincidence or accident, I guess you might say. My birthday is during the Halloween season. And my parents decided on my 10th birthday they were going to give me a new AM radio. And I was tuning around the AM radio that evening. And due to the fact that it was around Halloween, there were some radio talk shows, and they were talking about unusual happenings from haunted houses and ghosts and flying saucers and all kind of strange reports. And I was very curious and into science when I was 10 years old. And I wanted to know, gee, are these people making these stories up? Is there some truth to it? So I began to make a lot of trips to our local library and read all the books they had on UFOs and Bigfoot and whatever they had on mysterious subjects. And I began to watch the newspapers, and if I saw articles that were unusual, I'd clip them out, and I began to make scrapbooks. And as time went on, if something would appear in a local paper where somebody claimed to have seen, for example, a UFO, I called them on the phone, and I asked them questions about what they saw, and I began to keep records of it. And so my interest continued for many years, and I was 16 years old in 1965, when the Kecksburg incident happened about 12 miles from where I lived, and I got involved with that case as soon as that happened, and I started going out into the field to investigate at that point, and I've been out in the field ever since investigating literally thousands of UFO sightings over the years, hundreds of Bigfoot cases, and multitudes of many, many other strange reports.
Wow. Now, did you happen to keep those records?
Scrapbooks? Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
I probably have some of them. Unfortunately, we had a big flood here several years ago, and some things were lost. But I probably have some of those around somewhere.
I'm sure that government was behind that. So, listen, when you were, say you were young and you were going to the library and you were reading all these subjects, did you share this with your friends?
Oh, sure. I mean, we talked about it. And, you know, in high school, I talked about it and did papers on it. And people knew I was interested. And actually, I began to publicly to present programs to local groups. I believe I was still in high school, or just about out of high school, right after, in the late 60s, that I began to give presentations on the subject to various groups. And so I began educating the public at a very, very early age, and I still continue to do that at a continuous level.
You know, I have to ask you this question. Were you ever ridiculed about this?
You know, of all the years I've been doing this, if it was on such a small scale that it's something and it never really came into the situations I dealt with, because, you know, from the time I started doing this, I tried to do it very seriously, very scientifically. I should probably give a little background, because it'll lead up to some of the investigations anyhow, and how I really got involved in the field, and if you like me to do that at this time.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, I got involved with the Kexper case, like you said, in 1965, and late 1960s, I got involved with a small group in Pittsburgh. It was called the UFO Research Institute. It was people who were made up of the Pittsburgh NICAP subcommittee, and that was, I guess, shut down, and they started a separate group. And it was a small group of some Westinghouse scientists and others, and one of those people involved was Stanton Friedman. That's when he was just beginning his research.
Wow.
And I got involved with them. I was the youngster in the group, but I already had a lot of experience dealing with investigation and interviewing people. So I became the telephone sighting coordinator. So when they would get a report, it would come to me at my home, and I would do the initial interviews and determine if the case warranted further investigation. And I stayed on with them till they closed down. I think it was about 1969, somewhere around there. And I decided to set up my own hotline. So I began to make contact with the local news media and the police in this area. And, of course, I was still pretty young. A lot of ridicule back in those days with the subject. But I took it very seriously. I presented it very seriously. And I asked these officers, look, if you get any calls, even if you're not going to pursue it, if you let people know that I'm interested and let people know, I'd be glad to talk to them, you know, confidentially. I appreciate if you pass my number on. Well, within weeks, maybe months, as people began to hear about my hotline, my phone was ringing off the hook, I mean, day and night. And I was getting calls about not just UFOs, but anything strange and unusual, from alleged haunted houses to strange creatures to Bigfoot, you name it, the calls were coming in. Well, it got to very quickly that was much more than I could handle on my own. So I was of the position that I wanted to set up a volunteer group of research people who had backgrounds that could go out and investigate these cases properly to try to figure out what people were observing or encountering. And it was my focus to follow up and set up this volunteer group of scientists and engineers and technicians and others who would be able to respond around our jobs and go out to the scene, hopefully, while the phenomenon was ongoing, but to get there very soon to document what was occurring. So in 1970, I was able to do that. I founded the first of three volunteer groups. That was called the Westmoreland County UFO Study Group. So it started out as a small group about 30 miles east of Pittsburgh, and we looked into sightings around the Pittsburgh area, and by 1973, we pretty much had expanded to take over the whole state of Pennsylvania. And the group was very unique in that the majority of people involved had specially trained backgrounds. We did have many scientists. In fact, interestingly, we had from the big corporation in Pittsburgh, from Alcoa, Westinghouse, and Gulf, I should say. We had scientists and engineers. We had a lot of people associated with colleges and other facilities around Pittsburgh. We had major corporations that actually as a professional courtesy, offered to do analytical work in our labs for us, and we came up with any kinds of unusual materials in our investigations. We had former military intelligence people, law enforcement people, all kind of people with really interesting backgrounds who were volunteering their time to go out to investigate around the clock and around our jobs. And in many cases, we would be on the scene within minutes to hours. So we were able to document so many really interesting cases while the information was fresh. And so it was so interesting to get out there and see the emotions of the witnesses, to get the details, to see the animal responses, and in some cases find some really interesting physical evidence as well. And so anyhow, 1975, we had changed the name of the group to the Pennsylvania Center for UFO Research. And in 1981, I found another group called PASU, the Pennsylvania Association for the Study of the Unexplained, which served as a statewide clearinghouse for reports of all kind of unusual phenomena. And that continued to the end of 1993, and I've been working as an independent researcher ever since then. So I've had my hotline open from the public since 1969. It is still extremely active. I mean, I get calls here almost every day on either current or past reports or people looking for information. And so between my website, the emails coming in every day, and the phone calls coming in, I'm extremely busy with a lot of reports always ongoing here of all kind of phenomena.
Now, at the end of this this show, I'll ask you to give that number out if you'd like, and, of course, your website and all that. I wanted to talk quite a bit about the Kecksburg case. That's always fascinating me, and it's a pleasure to get to talk to you about it. But you mentioned that one of the groups closed in 1969. Did that have anything to do with the Project Blue Book closing at the same time? Like, was there any connection with the reason that thing
That was the group in Pittsburgh, the small group. And I really don't remember exactly what it was. I mean, I do remember somewhere around that time, it seems to me that some of those fellows may have got transferred out of the area. It was only a small group, but I really don't remember exactly. But my investigation just intensified, and that's when I set up my hotline and began to set up my own groups. And they became very, very active. In fact, I should tell you about this massive wave that happened in 1973. As I mentioned to you, our group by 73 was taken over the whole state of Pennsylvania, and it became quite well known. And what was really interesting to us was that we were beginning to get referrals from police departments across the state, from the news media. So many cases were being referred to our group to go out to investigate. So we were just being inundated with all kind of reports. But in 1973, we had the biggest UFO outbreak ever. And not only did we have the biggest UFO outbreak, but in the summer of 1973, we had an unprecedented biggest outbreak of Bigfoot sightings ever to occur anywhere. And it got into some of the most incredible cases that were ever documented. And if you'd like to get into some of that, I'd be glad to go over it with you.
Yes, but let's talk about, for the listener out there that's not familiar with Kecksburg, I'm sure most people are. It's always fascinated me when I've heard about this story. Why don't you just do kind of a nutshell of that case, if you would?
Okay, well, we could talk for days about Kecksburg. And interestingly, I was asked to speak at a very, very large local event here on the 4th of July. And there were like thousands of people came in this event, and I was there all weekend. And multitudes of witnesses came up who had all kind of incidents they had never reported before, whether it be Bigfoot sightings, UFOs. But that also included several other Kecksburg witnesses, people who had been on the scene that night who had never come forward. And that's not unusual because there's a lot of them still out there, even though many are now deceased. But anyhow, just to give you a little bit of the story, I remember that night. It happened very well. It was a Thursday night. It was December 9th of 1965. And how I got involved, I was prepared that evening to listen to KDK Radio in Pittsburgh, which was one of the big radio stations. And they had a very well-known radio talk show. It was called Contact. And the fellow, the host of the show, is now deceased. His name was Mike Levine. And the reason I was listening to that show that night was because he had a special guest on whose name you'll recognize. His name was Frank Edwards, who was a reporter who had written some books on UFOs and strange happenings. So I wanted to listen to Frank Edwards. Well, as I'm listening to the program, something became immediately apparent was the fact that they almost the entire program was focused on this UFO incident, which had occurred just actually a short time before, and they were just getting a lot of information was just coming in to the newsroom. It was a major news event. They were Mike Levine was reading some of the newswire stories, which is breaking. There were witnesses calling in. They were interviewing witnesses. There were reporters calling in, and they were trying to figure out just what exactly had taken place. And the initial reports indicated, excuse me, just getting over it, it's cold still, it's been hanging on, this brilliant fireball had been reported from the tip of Ontario, Canada, over Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And so anyhow, whatever this thing was, it apparently came in about 4:47 p.m. over the greater Pittsburgh area. So it's almost dark. And a lot of people, multitudes of witnesses, apparently saw this fiery object going across the sky. And some were the opinion it probably was maybe an aircraft on fire. So the news media around Pittsburgh and the police departments and the newspapers were just being overwhelmed with multitudes of reports that were coming in. So reports came in from a widespread area, including in the greater Pittsburgh area. And as the evening went on, more information began to come in that whatever that object was, it apparently fell into a wooded ravine. There's a small rural village of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, in Westmoreland County. And then that evening, I remember we had an old black and white console TV at the time, and I was running back and forth between the TV and the radio trying to get the latest reports. I wasn't driving, had no way to get out there, and trying to find all the latest information. I remember we had a local news reporter was very well known at the time. His name was Bill Burns, and he was breaking in on TV with live special reports that the military was now arriving in the Kecksburg area to search for an unidentified flying object. So it became a very exciting evening. I stayed up as late as I could to try to listen to all the stations and hear all the latest reports coming in. And anyhow, I couldn't wait to see what might be in the paper the next day. I was hoping it'd be at least an article in the local paper. Well, actually, what it turned out to be was it was the major front page story. Hmm. All the local papers, the Pittsburgh Press, the Post Gazette, the Greensburg Tribune View, our local large paper, had two editions at the time. The morning edition had a feature that on the top said, Army ropes off area, unidentified flying object falls near Kecksburg. So that was a very interesting story. It talked about the fact that this thing had been seen over a large area, that something apparently had fallen down into the woods, that nobody was allowed anywhere near the object. One, the theory was that whatever fallen may have been contaminated with radioactivity. They talked about the fact that they were awaiting possibly civilian scientists and Army engineers to arrive on the scene. And then I looked at the later edition of the paper, which had a number of different stories in. But the one story in particular that caught my attention was searchers failed to find object. And it went on to say that, yes, there was a search, but officially nothing had been found. And the official explanation was that people apparently had been mistaken. Nothing had fallen to the ground, that they had seen a bright meteor in the sky, and that was the end of the story. And officially, that's how it stands today. I remember the next day I was trying to find out immediately. I started to make calls around that area, but it's a very, very small little community. There was hardly any news names in the newspaper about who was involved. I knew one or two people around the area, and I tried to find information out. There was very, very little information to find. But I do clearly remember one thing. For days after that happened around the area, people were talking about seeing a large military flatbed tractor trailer truck carrying a large tarped object out of the area late that night at a high rate of speed. Well, anyhow, I began to keep what notes I could on the information. There was very little to find. But over weeks and months and years, I began to find people who were out there. There was a number of people out there. I began to get leads from relatives and friends and neighbors of people who were involved. And I began to realize that there's a lot more to this story than the meteor story. And so I really began to intensify my investigation in the 1980s. And it wasn't until 1987 when I was holding a very large public UFO display at one of the local malls that we found our first eyewitness, a witness that actually saw the object on the ground. And so what we now know, I mean, what I now know after interviewing hundreds of witnesses now after almost 49 years, is that there was a lot more to the story than anybody knew at the time. And in fact, there's many aspects of the case that we still don't have the answers for, and we may not ever have the answers. But what we now know is, whatever this object was, it came in from the Pittsburgh area, it moved out towards Westmoreland County, it moved over the city of Greensburg, and it moved out towards Route 30 East, but it made a turn to the south. And then we have all those little farming communities out there, such as Pleasant Unity and Marguerite and Norvelt and Mammoth, and all these people along that path saw the object going across the sky and moving out towards the mountains, out towards Laurelville. And others around there saw it as well. And the thing apparently kind of hesitated, made a turn, began to track back towards Kecksburg, made another turn, and then dropped down into that wooded ravine. And those people that saw it, I mean, there was one witness, for example, who unfortunately so many good witnesses are now deceased, but one witness was the late Randy Overly. He was a young boy, very sharp kid, and he never forgot what he saw that afternoon. He and his buddy were out there playing, and in the distance, they hear this hissing sound. And far off in the distance, they see this object beginning to approach them. And it's coming very slowly. And it passes about 200 feet overhead. And Randy said to him, it looked like a big kind of a brownish, grayish, acorn-shaped object. And he said that there was, like, different color flames around it. There was some type of, like, a vapor around it. And it was making that hissing sound, and it continued to pass overhead, continued out towards the mountains of Laurelville. So he watched it approach him, go very low overhead, and continue moving on because it was moving so slowly. So different people, depending on their vantage points or how close they were to it, some could just see a fiery object. Other people could see more detail to it, such as Randy. And those people who saw it come down, and what I should backtrack a little bit is, so what we know is, as this thing is coming in before it falls, it's moving relatively slowly, it makes change of direction along its path, and it makes a slow descent.
I don't think a meteor is going to do that.
I'm sorry?
I don't think a meteor is going to do that.
No, no. And the people that saw it go down said it was almost like a crash landing, because they said it came in like an aircraft on approach to an airport. It came down into that wooded ravine, and then right after it fell, there was a calm, like, bluish-gray smoke that went up, and that dissipated very quickly. So what we now found out after many years is that soon after it fell, a number of local people, first you had the local people, then you had some volunteer firemen, and then later you had the military came in, who came across the object down in the woods. So we now know that various independent locals, soon after it fell, they get down into the wooded ravine, and they come across this large, metallic, acorn-shaped object that's semi-buried in the ground. And some people are only a few feet away from it. Now, this thing, they estimate, is maybe 10 to 12 feet or more in length, approximately about 8 to 10 feet in diameter. But as one witness, who he had a background of as a machinist all his life, and he said, as he looked at this thing, he said it was kind of an off-gold bronze color. But he said it was such an odd-looking metal. And he said the best way he could describe it was, he said, it looked like somebody took liquid metal and poured it into an acorn-shaped mold. But it was big enough for a man to stand inside of. But what's interesting is, he said, there's no rivets, there's no weld marks, there's no seams. There's no fuselage, there's no windows, there's no wings. But on the raised-up back, they call the ring area or the bumper, like you'd have on an acorn, were these unusual markings that are raised up off the surface. And he said it wasn't writing, it was more like symbols. And in fact, the one witness, luckily, because of his background, he was somewhat familiar with Soviet writing, the Cyrillic, and he said that is definitely not what it was. In fact, he spent years in the library looking up ancient languages and ancient writings, and he said the closest thing he could remember was that the symbols looked similar to ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. And there are so many amazing stories, because what happened was, as this news is being broadcast all over Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, about this UFO incident. Well, hundreds of people descend on this little farming community to try to get a look at this thing down in the woods. So not only did you have hundreds of civilians coming in, but you had reporters there from all the major news networks, from radio, TV, newspapers. So interestingly, the reporters themselves became witnesses, because many of those people either interacted or saw the military themselves. Mm-hmm. So the big question is, what was so important that fell from the sky that the military responded with armed personnel to come out to that area? And what's interesting is a number of people have gone on record who try to get down into the woods to see the object. Now, you got to remember, this is a very large wooded area. It's dark. By the time people get in, it's dark. And a lot of people, a lot of these people came in were kids or teenagers. Well, a lot of these kids wanted to get down to see what was down in the woods. So they tried sneaking in from different vantage points. And a number of them told me how they were stopped by armed military personnel. But others went on record and said that in some cases, soldiers actually aimed their weapons at them to prevent them from going down into the, toward the crash site, toward the impact area. Now, where did that jurisdiction come from for armed soldiers to go on other people's private property to keep other civilians from going down on those other people's property? And, of course, officially, only three Air Force personnel were involved in the search. The only official document that's ever turned up was from the Project Blue Book files, and it's not listed under Kecksburg. It's listed under Acme, Pennsylvania. And I always thought that the reason was because I know that the Air Force interviewed a family who was within walking distance of where the object fell, but they had an Acme mailing address. So I always felt that's probably why they listed the case under Acme rather than Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. But there is so much to the story. We could talk for days and days about so many of the incidents that happened, people, how they interacted with the military, the things people saw and observed, some of the stranger aspects of the case, which, you know, if you want to get into it, we can. One thing I can tell you, in the summer of 1990, before we did the season premiere for Unsolved Mysteries on this case, which was the first big national show that really brought the case to the attention of the world, a man approached me, and he had a very extensive background, which I was able to confirm. He didn't know it at the time, but another person confirmed what he told me separately. But what he told me was, he said, he was a part of the Air Force security team that guarded the object when it came from Pennsylvania into Lockbourne Air Force Base near Columbus, Ohio, during the early morning hours of December 10th. He told me how they brought that flatbed tractor trailer with the tarped object on it into an entrance that's not normally used. They backed the flatbed trailer into a hangar, and they set up a security team around that hangar. And he said the security was extremely tight, and they were given a shoot-to-kill order to anybody to approach that hangar without the proper authority.
Wow.
Now, he told me he didn't stay on the team that long, and he heard it didn't stay at the base much longer, and it continued on to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, others independently contacted me and confirmed that it went to Wright-Patterson, and I was even told exactly what building it went to. Now, if it's still there today, we have no idea. But I'm quite certain that's where it ended up back in 1965.
Yeah, that's what I always had heard. Now, the case has so many speculations about it. You know, I've heard people speculate that it's the Nazi bell. I've heard people talk that, or I've heard an account that there was an alien that came out with three fingers or something like that. You hear all these things. What is the truth? What is the myth in those stories?
Well, this is where it gets into a very, very long series of information because there's so many details. Here's my position right now. My position is I keep an open mind to all possibilities of what the object was that fell. I have no doubt whatsoever that an object of still unknown origin did fall near Kecksburg and was recovered by the military. My two thoughts at this point is that, one, either with some extremely very secretive, very advanced man-made space probe that has some type of reentry control capability for that time period, or we're dealing with something that's extraterrestrial. Now, over the years, numerous people have contacted me independently. And these various people all came to me and said they knew without any doubt what the Keksberg object was. And interestingly, all the different origins are different. And there are many different. I mean, the first thing we heard was that an Air Force officer apparently told a witness was on the scene that a Gemini capsule had been expelled in the area. Well, we know that's not the case. So that was one of the first explanations I heard. And it wasn't well known. It wasn't in the papers at the time, as far as I know. Another person contacted me, and he said he was certain that this was a projectile that was fired from a giant gun from on a railroad car in Canada. Well, we know that isn't the case because what he described and what it did and the dimensions are completely different. It just doesn't fit whatsoever. Another person told me he was certain it was a Soviet ICBM that came down. Another person thought it was a missile. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And there's all kind of theories out there. And the Nazi bell, the Gluck, it wasn't until more recent years, as some books began to come out on the subject, that people began to contact me. All those years before that, while many, many people did contact me about many different explanations, that's one that never surfaced until that began to occur. But again, I don't have an explanation at this point. I keep an open mind to all possibilities. But again, you got to remember now, we're dealing with the early days of the space program. This thing is relatively large. There's no weld marks or rivets or seams on it. Nobody ever reported this thing was descending and dropped with a parachute, which a lot of the landers back in those days were coming down parachutes, as you recall. Mm-hmm. This thing made changes in direction along its path and made a slow descent. Okay, so now you were asking me about the stories about the bodies. Well, this is very interesting, and I'll see if we get some of this in really quickly. I can tell you, for years I heard rumors that allegedly some bodies were found at the scene. I've never seen any evidence to substantiate that whatsoever. However, some interesting things have developed over the years. When I was filming my documentary called Keksberg, the Untold Story, on this case, I had interviewed a retired truck driver. His name was Myron. And Myron had told me, he had contacted me after seeing the Unsolved Mysteries TV show, because he said, now that it's on TV, I guess I'm allowed to talk about it. So Myron went on to tell me how he and another truck driver, during that time, within a few days after the object fell in Pennsylvania, he was working for a large supply house in Ohio. And they had gotten an order from, which he believed was from the Navy. The Navy, remember that, for a large supply of a special type of glazed engineering brick to be taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Well, the other truck driver, who initially didn't want to get involved, didn't want to confirm anything, but later he did. He later confirmed that he took the first load of bricks into Wright-Patterson. And when he got there that day, the flatbed tractor trailer with the tarped object was outside this building. And so he confirmed that later to us. Now, the next day, he and Myron both went to the base, and they had two truckloads of these special type of bricks. And they were just told to do their job, unload your bricks, you know, and just don't be looking around. Well, Myron was very curious because he kept seeing coming out of this big building. And by the way, the flatbed and the object was not there the next day. Anyhow, he kept seeing these guys on white coveralls that had sidearms and, I believe, rubber gloves and protective gear. They would go in and out of the building, and every once in a while they'd come out and change some of their outer clothing. And he was trying to figure out what's going on in there. So at one point when he didn't see anybody around, he went over to the entrance and looked inside. And up in the scaffolding, there's scaffolding with ladders going up, and here was this big kind of metallic acorn-shaped object with the unusual hieroglyphic markings at the bottom, and he got a pretty good look at it. He said it was not well lit in there. There was some light, and he said it was almost like a parachute was hanging from the top almost to cover, to camouflage this thing. And these guys were up on ladders and apparently trying to get inside of this thing. And at one point, I guess he started asking some questions of one of the fellows. And I guess the guy at first must have thought he had clearance, and then he realized he didn't. And at one point he was threatened and said something along the line that, you know, you're not ever to talk about what you saw, or we'll throw you in jail and throw away the keys, but in 20 years this will all be public knowledge. Well, of course, 20 years went by, and nobody still knows the truth about what happened. But, excuse me, anyhow, Myron had some very interesting details. Well, anyhow, the interesting thing was when I went to interview him when I was doing my documentary, Myron was not in good health. He was on oxygen. He had a number of other health issues. And at that point, when he got there, to my surprise, he wanted to tell me something else. And he said he had talked to his son, I believe, the night before, and his son said, why you can't even tell him? He said, because I may not be here tomorrow to tell anybody, and I want him to know. Anyhow, what he went on to tell me was that when he was inside the room, inside of that building, he said there was a table in there, and like a work table. And on that table was appeared to be a small body, and I believe it was around four and a half feet, he estimated, somewhere in that area. It was covered over with a white sheet, so he really couldn't see any detail at all, except he could see the one arm hanging down. And he said all he could see were like three fingers, three digits, and the skin looked lizard-like. That's all he could see. Hmm. And many, many times I tried to get him to change the story, to give me more detail, and he kept telling me, that's all I could see. So we thought, that's pretty interesting. Now, what you got to do now is go back. The fact that there was some things going on at the scene that were interesting. For example, one very reputable witness, his name was Bill Weaver. He was a teenager at the time. He had his dad's car, and he was listening to the local radio station when it came over about the UFO falling in the area. He was close by, so he decided to go over, as many other people did, to try to see what this thing was. And he found himself on this dirt road, which was the closest area to the impact site. Most of the other people are way up on the other side of the hill along what is now called Meteor Road. It was a very narrow farming road that paralleled along the heavy woods where this thing fell, but the people didn't realize it actually had fallen way on the opposite side of the woods down in a ravine where you couldn't possibly see it from any roads. And so that's where most of the reporters and most of the activity was up there. But several people found themselves on this farm lane, which is where most of the military activity was going on and other activities were taking place. And one of the things that Bill saw while he was there, a big white unmarked panel truck pulls up. And out of that panel truck come four guys in what he called moon suits, protective outfits. And they got out some kind of device. He said it was like a 4x5 square box on a stretcher, something on like a stretcher, and they carried it down towards the ravine where the object came down. So this, whatever this container was, it's too small to put the object in. So the question is, what was that container for?
Hmm.
And there were other things that were being seen by other people that is not well known. At least two people I can think of off the top of my head also told me that at a distance they saw soldiers carrying what appeared to be stretchers, but they couldn't see what was on the stretcher. They don't know. Okay, so now go ahead a little more in time here, a little more recently, okay, to try to get my ears all together here. I believe it was November of 2002 when the Sci-Fi Channel was backing the investigation on the Kexford case. That's when the Coalition for Freedom of Information, led by Leslie Kane, chose the Kexford case for a major investigation. So they were able to get into some areas and do some extensive research connected with the case from around the country that I wasn't able to do on my own. And they tracked down some very interesting information, tracked down some very interesting key witnesses, and we did a lot of research on the case. And as news was getting out locally here that this big investigation was going to take place, well, more and more witnesses realizing this was going to be a serious investigation, more people who were involved began to come forward. So I had a big list of people to follow up on. But there was one particular name. I'll just call the fellow Joel, because Joel's name stuck out. because it had been, I can't remember now, 13, 14 years before at that time, that his name had come up from another source. And I contacted him at the time because he allegedly had been hiding down in the woods when they were recovering the object. And he had seen a lot of things. And I contacted him, and he didn't deny it. He just said, look, I don't want to get involved. I'm afraid the government, my family doesn't want me involved. And that's the end of the story. So anyhow, now that I see his name on there, I was very interested, and I contacted him right away, and I made arrangements to go out to talk with him. And when I got there, he was, you could tell he was very nervous. Said, look, he said, I was going to call you and cancel it. My family really doesn't want me involved in this thing. But we talked a little bit, and as we talked a little more, he said, well, now you're here, I'll tell you some of the story. Well, that led to numerous other investigations, numerous other interviews with him. But as we're talking, and he's describing what happened, and what he's telling me was how he and his brother had seen the object went across the sky that afternoon, how it changed direction, and then he heard later that it went down into the wooded ravine. Well, he knew the area like others because he used to hunt down there. So it's pretty much dark. He had a flashlight. His brother wouldn't get down. He stayed up on the road, but he decided he was going to get down. And he said he was able to find where this thing was because of this, like, electrical arcing from the woods, which others described, something along that line. So he followed it down, and he was hiding deep in the woods, and he could see the object from where he was hiding, but he said he was hiding because first those civilian people came in, and then he began to see Army and Air Force personnel. And he was trying to keep, like, branches and stay within the trees so they couldn't see him. And as more and more were coming in, they're starting to set up a security perimeter around there. So you have to keep backing up at some point. But anyhow, I'm trying to hurt the story. He said, as he's standing there, a high-ranking Army officer jumps on top of the object. And he said he had a long metal pole, something like a policeman's billy club. And this guy's on top of this thing, and for whatever reason, he struck it. He hit it real hard. And at that point, you could hear the emotion, the change in his voice. He was very, very upset. And he began to say something to me like, I swear to God, sir, I swear to God, sir, there was something inside of that thing. And he said when that officer hit that thing, all of a sudden there was this very unusual, like, there was a high-pitched sound and like a hatch open in the front from right to left. Oh. And he said all he could see from where he was one, like a real long, like an elastic arm, and he can only see like two fingers from where he was, that position. And he said there had to be another arm because that hatch closed very quickly. You could hear it hit metal on metal, but he couldn't see the other arm from his position. And the officer started screaming, hurry up, we don't have much time. And that's when all the soldiers came over, and he went into detail how they began to strap this thing and how they had to winch this thing over because you couldn't take the trucks right down to the site because of all the trees down there, and how they loaded this thing up on the flatbed truck. And it was a very, very detailed account. And when you listen to what he said, and then you listen to what Myron told us, and then you hear some of these other accounts, if these people are telling the truth, and I just, after interviewing so many people over the years, I had the feeling that they were telling me to the best of their ability what they recalled. Then you have to wonder, was there someone or something inside of this thing?
That is amazing. I never heard this before.
Yeah, and there's a lot more detail we just don't have time to get into.
Yeah, yeah. There's a question up on the message board from Ali, and he says, as a retired firefighter, after each call, an incident report would be filled with within the station files.
Exactly.
Yeah. Has there been a search conducted in respect to files at the Kecksburg Fire Department?
I did multitudes of FOIA reports, FOIA to many, many different agencies. On the local level, we began to search everywhere we could, from airports to, you know, the 911 centers. All those files from that time period, they didn't keep them. Because they weren't required to keep them because it was so many years later. So nobody. But the thing that's interesting, and I learned this many, many years ago, because some of the expert firemen were directly involved in this event. And unfortunately, the last expert fireman who was involved with some of the operations passed away last year, Robert Bittner. And but I remember being told from some of the old-timers years and years ago that, interestingly, the records, the activities report for the truck, like the trucks they would take out, those reports for that time period were all missing, which they thought was highly unusual. There's a lot of little things we've come up with that are very, very intriguing. It makes you wonder, like, what's going on? And, you know, there's so much information on this case, and there's a lot of mystery to it, too. And, there's so many unanswered questions.
You know, when you said that the officer climbed on top of the thing and whacked it, that is the most bizarre thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't really make any sense. And yet there was a reaction almost like he knew what he was doing in a way.
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, for the witness to bring this up, like, you know, if you're going to make up a story, you can make up a much more believable story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I request him many, many times on this. And he, you know, and he always called the thing the hickey. He said he called it the hickey. And he was watching a lot of things going on. And one other thing he brought up was very interesting. He said to me, he said, I could never understand why there was, what he said was, why there was a politician. I believe it was a politician down in the woods. I said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, this guy's down there where all the stuff going on, and I believe there was others, but one in particular he was talking about. And he said he was in a black suit with a black tie with a black dress hat on, and he was telling the military what to do. In fact, he seemed to be in charge. And he said this guy had a camera, and this guy was taking pictures from all angles of the broken trees, of the object down there. He said he could see. He had to keep moving his position back as they're loading it on the truck, but he said you could see that camera strobes is flashing and flashing, and they were taking all kind of pictures down there. And so I'm saying there are so many amazing stories that people don't know about with the case.
Right. Stan, we have about 5 minutes left. I'm going to ask you this question here. Now, you listen to everybody's testimony along the way. What do you think, personally? Give us your opinion on what you think that object may have been.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, my two thoughts are we're either dealing with something that was extremely, extremely secretive, which you would think by now we would know, as some type of a man-made secretive project, very advanced for that time, as some type of space probe that had some type of reentry control capability, or we're dealing with something that's extraterrestrial. So that's my two main ideas right now is what we might be dealing with.
Yeah, if you had to lean, I hate to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. If you had to lean one way or the other?
Right now, I got to keep an open mind. I see a lot of data. There's too much to even begin to discuss right now, but I'd say those are the two ideas that probably are the strongest right now for the possibilities.
Yeah, yeah. And you said that the Nazi bell came up after a story came out. Are people still really pushing that idea?
Well, no, there's, you know, a lot of people really aren't pushing it. There's a lot of people who think that's very interesting. There's some similarities in shape. Because something is similar in appearance doesn't necessarily mean it's the same thing. Because there were, in fact, various Soviet and U.S. projects at the time that were somewhat similar in shape. But when you really get down to the details and the way this thing maneuvered and the construction of the body, it just doesn't fit. After talking over the years to various NASA engineers and others, a lot of them just scratch their heads when they hear the details.
Right, right. Now let's shift gears a little bit here. Up on the message board, Bobby wants to know about last year, June 2013, there was a flying rectangle UFO in North Huntington Township. Did you investigate that?
Yes, I did. That's one of multitudes. It's probably one of the best UFO cases we've had in years. It's one of those, like the classic type of UFO case we used to hear about a lot in the 50s and 60s. This was on a major highway, Route 30, North Huntington, 25 miles or so outside of Pittsburgh. A woman who did not believe in UFOs and a three-year-old child riding down Route 30. She has to almost stop in the middle of the road because here's this about 55-foot-long metallic rectangular object about 60 feet above the road, taking all four lanes of the highway up. The lighting on it is completely unlike any type of navigational lighting. It makes no sound. The little three-year-old yells, "Mommy, flying iPad in the sky." And they have to pass underneath this, and that she does. All the electronics on the dash of her car goes out. The clock goes out. She loses the FM radio signal. Her cell phone signal goes off. She tries to take a picture with her iPhone. It wouldn't let it go into the photo mode. She goes down the road, and all the electronics comes back on. Yes, I did a very intensive investigation of it, and there have been quite an increase in rectangular-shaped objects in more recent years.
Wow. Boy, you know, you hear that so many times about the radios and everything going out. Hey, Stan, we have a couple minutes, or we have just about a minute left, actually. Why don't you give out your website, and if you'd like, go ahead and give out your phone number. You say people call
okay.
you.
My website is stangordon, GRDN.info, INFO. They can contact me through email on there. I deal basically in Pennsylvania case, but I'm glad to talk to anybody. 724-838-7768. My two books are Really Mysterious Pennsylvania and Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook, available on Amazon.com or autographed copies on my website at stangordon.info.
Yep. Excellent. Okay. So, well, thanks so much, Stan. And we'll have to have you back on sometime to talk about other situations.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of very strange things that go on here all the time in Pennsylvania. I've got lots of intriguing reports.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's it for our show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is Podcast UFO. And you can also check out our links in the show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. Our guest next week will be Ray Stanford. I'm pretty excited about that. He hasn't been on an interview in many years. And we're going to be talking about his book, The Socorro Flying Saucer Incident. I think it's called The Socorro Flying Saucer in the Pentagon Pantry. And I want to thank everyone for helping out today with the show. Our guest, of course, Stan Gordon. Fred Ling, who helped produce the show. I don't know if I'm going to have him back or not. Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network. Andy Fleming for our Kepler clip, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out live next week right here at the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump into the chat room at Podcast UFO. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high.